Watch out now, boy. You about to get too hot there. My Uncle Bill's got a still on the hill where he runs off a gallon or two. Little birds in the sky get struck. They can't fly from smelling that good old Mountain Dew. Oh, they call it that old Mountain Dew. And them that refuse it are few. I'll hush up my mug if you'll fill up my jug with that good old Mountain Dew.
Well, hello, everybody. It's every other Sunday again, and this is Sustainability Now. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz. Anyhow, my guest will be David Bloom, CEO and Director of Research and Development at Bloom Distillation in Watsonville. As I mentioned, he's the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. His primary insight follows from that of Buckminster Fuller, who wrote the foreword to the first edition of the book in 1983, that alcohol, or ethanol, is a renewable variety of solar energy in liquid form, the cultivation of which can enhance soils, be used as a minimally or non-polluting fuel, and enable farmers and individuals at large to make fuel locally. And I've been describing as best I can the operation, including the greenhouse and the way in which you're using all of the byproducts of the distillation process and the toads and the lizards and all of this kind of stuff, because to me it's just fascinating. Tell me about your background. How did you get into this business?
Oh, gosh. Well, it's a funny story. I was an ecology and biosystematics student a million years ago at SF State. And I had a brilliant professor, Doc Sweeney, who was retiring the following year, so nobody could touch him. And he said, well, you know, I've all these years been teaching, so I'm going to start lying to you kids. And if any of you can catch me lying, then I'll take you to lunch. And I was angling for my burrito the very first day. So, you know, there's a bottle of yeast and beer fermenting on the table as we're going through our lecture. And he turns around and just kind of nods at it and says, that stuff would run your car, and goes back to the board. And I jump up in the back of the room and say, you're a liar. And of course, he was just waiting for someone to do that. And he said, prove it. He called me out in front of the whole class. So off I go to the library, figuring, no way. Gasoline's been the only fuel. It's the way it is. And I was shocked. I got there and I found a stack of books that I took out of the library, 3 feet tall, that was all about alcohol as a fuel before gasoline was ever invented. So I was hooked. It was the first time in my life, and we've all had this moment, where you realize not everything you're told is true. And that was my first moment of that kind of thing. And so I was hooked at that point. But then I delved deeply into the subject and realized, oh my, we had a really good way to power things long before this waste product called gasoline showed up.
Yeah.
Well, you know, just a quick history. Rockefeller came along later, and he was making heating oil. In other words, kerosene. So all the volatile stuff, you know, kerosene's kind of like oil.
Yeah, no. It was a replace whale oil, basically, for lighting, right? And yeah.
But of course, they were also using kerosene for heating, and and the volatile parts of oil, which we would nowadays call gasoline. Nobody wanted to put that in an oil lamp and light it, because that's like lighting a Molotov cocktail. That was a bad idea. So Rockefeller used to flush that stuff into the rivers at night, where it floated on top of the water and would catch on fire. And people didn't like that so much. When he figured out he could run it in these alcohol cars like the Model T, see, well, here he was, almost being a permaculturist, finding a way of using the waste product and making a profit with it. So even today, gasoline is the waste product of making a whole bunch of valuable stuff out of oil, like linoleum or carpeting or, you know, here's this resin desk or nylon stocking. All that stuff's
basically
worth a lot
plastic,
more money.
Yeah.
And so whatever's left over, well, they throw it together and call gasoline. That's about half the oil. So
I recall the Shah of Iran once said that petroleum is much too valuable to be burned. And he was referring to, you know, things like plastic medical devices and things like that, as I recall.
All that high-value stuff. You know, someday, you know, kids, you read this in science fiction books all the time, they're going to look at their parents or their grandparents and say, You burned oil? What were you thinking? It was so useful. But it's useful, but anything except for burning, because that's when we get into the problems.
Right, the CO2 problem. But I also noticed that you were involved in permaculture, right?
Yes, I used to teach with Bill Mollison, the founder of permaculture, many years ago, and I'm still interested today. You know, a lot of that goes on at my farm in Watsonville.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to also to sort of get at, you know, the way in which you're producing all of these products, which are look like byproducts, but you're using them, like the carbon dioxide, right? And the methane and the, all of these things that otherwise might basically be vented.
Well, you know, that's true. But in permaculture, one of the things we say is there's no bad or good. There's surpluses and shortages.
Yeah. Okay.
So surpluses just need to find a use so that they're not a surplus anymore, that they're being used for something else. And shortages are, well, needing something that isn't there. So, you know, when I'm, you know, using something to make alcohol, I have all this stuff left over because all I take out is the sugar or maybe the starch if that's what's in it. So let's say you're using corn, right? The thing, the big alcohol plants use in the United States.
Yeah.
The byproduct of what's left over after we take out the starch is basically protein and fat. So that's the waste product.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh. You know, so if we take the waste product, which is used for animal feed, just like the original corn would have been. Over 90% of the corn grown in the U.S. is fed to animals. So if we take the starch out and then we feed the protein and fat to animals, they gain 17% more weight than if you would have fed them the original corn, because cattle can't digest starch. They poop it out. So by taking the starch out first, we're taking the surplus, the starch that the cows couldn't use, we're making alcohol with it, and now because we're doing proper design, which is what permaculture is about, we get more meat and we get fuel.
Is there anything else that you can do with that, you know, the leftovers?
Besides, oh, of course.
So, for example, what? I'm thinking about the future of meat, okay? That, you know, there's a lot of pressure to give it up because of what's fed to cattle. Right, and methane and so on. So I'm sort of wondering, what other ways could you use those particular byproducts that you would use, you know, that you're talking about for animal feed?
Well, remember, byproducts or main products are a matter of perspective.
Right, sure, of course.
So corn,
you're doing alcohol.
So I'm bringing that up because if you take a look at what's in corn, well, the most of it, 70% is starch.
Yeah.
Now, what's starch? It's a carbohydrate.
Right.
So carbo means carbon dioxide. Hydrate means water.
Mm-hmm.
So all of our sugars and starches are carbon dioxide and water and solar energy to glue it together.
Right.
So when we make alcohol from carbohydrates, like the starch in corn, well, now when we burn the alcohol, well, what do we get back? The solar energy powers the car.
Right.
It's the explosion that drives the pistons, makes the car go. And what goes out the exhaust pipe? Carbon dioxide and water.
Right.
So that actually is not a bad thing, where it would be from gasoline, because that carbon dioxide and water came from this year's crop.
Right.
So
right.
When we send it back to the atmosphere, well, the carbon dioxide and water is used by next year's crop to make carbohydrates for fuel. So it's a loop, an emission.
Right.
So what we're talking about here is living honestly with our solar income, because our plants take the sun, combine the carbon dioxide and water, and make the sugars and starches to run our vehicles, and we got a lot of sunlight.
Yeah, actually, that raises a math question, you know, which is, if you look, so the carbohydrates are basically the result of photosynthesis. Photosynthesis is a fairly inefficient conversion process, but it doesn't matter.
No.
Because there's so much sun,
right? That's
right. As compared to photovoltaics, now I know this is apples and oranges, alcohol and electricity, but I'm just sort of curious, do you know the numbers? I could probably do them given enough time. Looking at the sort of relative efficiency of PV conversion versus alcohol production. I mean, there's a whole life cycle question here, of course.
All right. Well,
but
I'll go ahead and put my foot in it and get in lots of trouble here, because it takes 10 tons of material to make one solar panel. So there's an enormous, what we would call, embedded energy and material quotient that goes into making a solar panel. Now, solar panels do last for 40 years. So that's great for making electricity, but we don't run our cars on electricity, and we really never will.
Yes, you're convinced of that.
Oh, yes. Electric cars were invented before gasoline cars, and we can see who won, you know?
Well, Rockefeller won.
But electric cars were first.
No, I know that. We'll come back to that because I have to take a break, okay? You're listening to KSQD 90.7 in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org, and we'll return to the program in just a moment.
Got an old car taking up space in your garage or driveway? Why not put a squid behind the wheel? Donate your used car to KSQD through the Car Easy Donation Program. They even make the arrangements to have it towed. You get a tax deduction, and KSQD gets a monetary contribution. For more information, go to the donate page of our website, ksqd.org. Thanks.
Okay, you're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Dave Bloom, who is the CEO and head of director of research and development at Bloom Distillation in Watsonville. I started the program by raving about my tour on Friday, and we've just been talking about the sort of comparative energetics of photovoltaics and alcohol. And, of course, as part of your design, you have your colleague, your associate, showed this combined heat and electricity sort
That's
of
right.
design, right? Which would produce both process heat or heat for the greenhouse, right? And electricity to basically run whatever you need.
Sure.
And I'm sort of wondering, you know, again, you get with that, you would get what, something like 60% efficiency, right? If you
It can be much higher.
Can it be? Yeah.
Basically, when you run an engine, a car engine, or otherwise the engine
for
a generator.
Well, I'm thinking about the electricity generator, you know, combined heat and power, right?
That's correct.
What's the conversion efficiency of the fuel in terms of energy that comes out of it?
So when you just make electricity from a fuel, in other words, burn it in an engine that turns a generator, you only get about 30% efficiency.
Right.
The rest of it is waste heat and exhaust.
Yep.
All right. So when we go ahead and recover the heat, and if we do a really good job of that, it can be more like a total of 70-75% of the total energy in the fuel is then made useful, both heat and electricity. And a little bit goes away because of friction and
thermodynamics,
the mass of exhaust and that kind of thing. So we can get a lot more energy out of our fuel. And so electricity basically is 30% of an original fuel. So if we put alcohol in a car, well, you know, we're getting its efficiency. But if we're talking about electricity, it's not any more efficient because we use the fuel to get it. Now, of course, if we use photovoltaics, then you get into the interesting question of the energy it took to make the panel. Do you ever get that energy back out over the life of the panel? And it's a pretty close match.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no magic bullet yet. But alcohol is a good one because everything we get out of the alcohol process has a use. So in good design, all the things that come out of making the fuel matter, like food.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, the byproduct from alcohol you mentioned earlier, what happens to the byproduct from corn after making alcohol if we don't feed it to animals? Well, it's exactly what the crop was this year, minus the solar portion. So minerals come from the soil, become stuff in the plant, and then the carbohydrate, the starch or sugar, is from solar energy and carbon dioxide, not from the soil.
Right.
So when we take that part away to make alcohol, what's left is everything from the soil.
Mm-hmm.
If you use that and put it back in the soil as fertilizer, it's everything you need to know, grow next year's crop without any fossil fuel fertilizer.
Yeah, yeah.
So when we are doing a really good job with the multiple things we can make from a plant, some of it can go back to growing more plants. And generally, you need only about 90% of those nutrients, because some come from really deep and are brought up to the surface, and now they're available when we put them back on the surface. So there's some really interesting efficiency that goes to increasing the food supply when we make alcohol.
So essentially what you've done is you've put together a permaculture system with alcohol distillation, right? I mean, ultimately, could one imagine a farm where the organic wastes, that you could close the loop, really? This is the golden... This is the goal, is to close the loop so that there aren't any wastes, or there are minimal wastes coming off of the various parts of the cycle. And, what you're doing is really starts to capture that in a very sort of visible and visceral way.
We're all really sold on this idea of a closed loop, but, the world is not a closed loop. In fact, energy is not a closed loop. We have this incredible income every day of gazillions of BTUs of energy from the sun. So when I think about what do we want to do in terms of designing a system for humans, I look at it like we have all this energy coming in every day, which whether we use it or not, it's coming. It's right. Solar energy. So if we start thinking, instead of can we make our own little survivalist, self-sufficient, self-reliant thing, or really, what should we think of ourselves as a region? So in comes energy from the sun, and we use it regionally, and what we make goes out to wider regions. So if I go ahead and make alcohol in Santa Cruz, well, I could use it to produce energy in Salinas for a cannabis farm.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But when I make the energy for the cannabis farm with a generator, well, the exhaust is carbon dioxide. I can put that into the greenhouse where they're growing the cannabis, and now I will triple the yield per square foot by increasing the CO2 within, more than natural mm-hmm. inside mm-hmm. the greenhouse. And that has an effect of reducing my tax burden by 2/3, because the way they tax cannabis is by the square foot of the greenhouse. So if I get triple the yield, you see, so what I'm trying to say is, with all of that, is as we design a system, it's both plain old, physics and chemistry, and then it becomes, economics, and then it becomes, direct things that have to do with human interactions like taxation. So systems design is a lot bigger than just talking about can we get as much energy out as in. And the answer is solar energy is, for the next, 4.5 billion years is going to be free. And when the sun burns out, we have other problems. So let's not talk about that.
You have to get there first.
Yeah.
I had a question, and let's talk about scale.
All right.
Okay. I mentioned that a little bit. But how do you envision, scaling up? Is it a demo or a pilot that you've gotten, Watson? But what do you call it right now?
Well, it's our research alcohol plant.
Okay.
It's capable of producing 100,000 gallons a year, which
okay.
is not a demo. That's something you might do on a lab table. But this is more of a pilot.
Yeah,
the idea is that solar energy is diffuse, and we're collecting solar energy with plants if we're talking about agriculture. So where's the scale fit? And for me, it's a lot smaller than the way it's done currently in the Midwest. In the Midwest, they're making 50 and 100 million gallon per year plants. They look like oil refineries. Well, there's no accident there. People are, engineers are thinking the way they're used to thinking about big stuff. But how much corn does it take to feed one of these 100 million gallon per year plants? That's a lot of alcohol.
Wow.
So that takes half of all the cropland within a 45-mile radius of the plant. If you're 46 miles, it costs too much to transport it into the plant to be worth it. So that is a scaling limit for the really big plants. But now, when you make alcohol, you add lots of water to the ground up corn to make mash, like making beer.
Right.
At the end of the process, you've got 9 gallons of water and 1 gallon of alcohol, roughly. now what are you going to do with the 9 gallons of water? Well, you can't transport that out by truck to 45 miles. So now you've got a disposal problem. So what they do in the alcohol industry in the Midwest is they boil that water and evaporate it back into the air. That uses half the energy you would get out of the alcohol. So by going too big, you make scaling problems that you can't economically justify.
Quick question.
Yes.
You know, given that there's petroleum inputs into growing corn.
Oh,
right?
Yes.
Growing and moving corn, right? And now you're telling me that boiling off the water is what, you said 45% or
45% of the energy of produced, making alcohol.
Of making, right. How much net energy do you actually get out of these plants?
Well, about 60% more energy out than in, even with all the stupid inefficiencies.
Really? Uh-huh.
But okay, now if you look at the way I do things on a much smaller scale, so instead of looking at all that water with nutrients in it at the end of the process as a waste product to be evaporated, well, what I would do is take that and return it to the land as fertilizer, and I'd replace all the fossil fuel fertilizer. Because I'm in a small enough area in doing a small plant, maybe we're looking at 1,000 acres or 500 acres. That's smaller than the average farm in the Midwest, you know. So you're looking at putting that nutrient back on the land. But now the most expensive thing that you have to buy to farm, the fertilizer, you don't need anymore. Mm-hmm. So when you have the proper scale, economics works out perfectly well, and ecologically it works out perfectly well. And when you get too big, you make a big mess.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about 5 million gallon a year scale for the full-blown plant, right?
That's what we at Bloom Distillation are doing, because our model primarily to start with is using agricultural processing waste. So let's say you go up to the Atchas Salinas, where they make prunes at one of the processing plants there. Well, if we want to take the prunes that are not good enough to go in the bag, and we take that waste and we make alcohol with it, and we look around the plants, the factories that are in the area, 5 million gallons is a pretty good size, and we don't have to go more than 2-3 miles in a radius to get our raw materials and the waste products that otherwise have to go somewhere, usually more than 3 miles, to a landfill. Oops, wait a minute. As of this year, California says you can't take those waste to the landfill anymore, because when you bury them in a landfill, all that methane. Nice, juicy plant stuff makes methane, as you just said, which is maybe a 60 to 100 times worse climate change gas than carbon dioxide. So, gosh, we can't take it to landfill anymore, and suddenly there's a problem. And so what's happening is counties are asking us to please take the food processing waste with our alcohol plants and process them first, and then whatever we have left over can go in the methane digester and make natural gas. Right. But without the gigantic load of all the stuff the methane digesters were never built for. So, you know, we are more than happy to do that. And we'd even charge the food processors less than they're paying now to dump it.
Right. So, so you're taking the waste from what, 2-3 mile radius, right?
Yes, that's what we want to do.
And then how do you envision the sort of distribution radius for the 5 million gallons?
Well, see, that can go really far. Moving the raw material, which is mostly water, that's really expensive and difficult. Moving the finished product could actually be done internationally. I mean, it's such a valuable product. Alcohol, when we use it for pharmaceutical extraction, which is how we make half the drugs in the United States. I mean, if you take willow branches and chop them up and stick them in a 5-gallon bucket full of alcohol and swirl it around a little bit, and then you take out the willow branches, evaporate the alcohol, well, there's powder left in the bottom of that 5-gallon bucket, and that powder is called aspirin. So half of our drugs are made that way, using alcohol to extract plant material to make active ingredients. So, you know, alcohol that's pure enough for that, which we know how to make, and that's what we do at our plant, is worth upwards of $100 a gallon. not sure beats gasoline, replacement at $2 a gallon.
Yeah.
Then, of course, there's the college student's favorite, which is alcohol as a beverage,
right?
And although it's edible, a lot of us have woke up from days when we were in college thinking that it was definitely a poison. but alcohol is, as a beverage, has got a very long history. Some people say it was mankind's second oldest profession. Some say it was first because Adam was kind of a rough looking guy and maybe Eve had to get drunk before she'd go anywhere near him.
I'm not sure you're allowed
to
say that anymore on the radio.
But... Oh, really? Eve? Okay. So anyway, so alcohol's been around as long as humans have been around and we've been taking advantage of it. So beverage is, around $20, $30 a gallon wholesale, depending on what it is. No, not in a bottle, but just white label vodka where people flavor it and call it gin and that kind of stuff. And then, of course, there's fuel at $2 or $3 a gallon. So the plant we're building in Watsonville, the bigger plant we're building, will be making a mixture of those things. Mm-hmm. The fuel alcohol will actually get used in a novel way. We have done trials with the Pajaro Valley School District replacing diesel with alcohol, which is considered fairly exotic. I mean, alcohol replacing gasoline, it happens almost without any modification at all. A little more complicated to convert a diesel. But the emissions from diesel fuel are really wickedly toxic. We're not talking about climate change here. We're talking about
fumes,
mutagens and carcinogens and tetrogens, which cause, birth defects in embryos. And it goes on and on, the bad stuff that's in diesel exhaust. So some of these kids are spending 45 minutes a day on the bus, and they're breathing that stuff. Mm-hmm. So the school district doesn't want it anymore, and they want us to go ahead and use alcohol, which is a good thing that they want us to do it because the state, once again, is starting this year to make diesel illegal in certain classes of vehicle, and eventually California will be a diesel-free state in a few years.
Okay, you're listening to KSQD 90.7 and KSQD.org on the internet. The second and fourth Sundays of the month, KSQD presents Faith Matters, hosted by Seth Shapiro. Faith Matters is an interfaith discussion with leaders from a variety of religious and spiritual traditions. The discussion is wide-ranging and respectful, and call-ins are welcome. Tune into Faith Matters Sunday evening at 6, KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org. KSQD, many voices, one station. You're listening to Sustainability Now. This is Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is David Bloom from Bloom Distillation in Watsonville. We're talking, most recently, we're talking about the radius of materials and service for one of the 5 million gallon design plants.
Alcohol plants.
Plants, right. Now, I'm presuming, or am I presuming incorrectly, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the design that I saw on Friday, which fits into a shipping container.
Yes.
Because that's also quite interesting.
Well, we're working on some pretty advanced stuff with that because you go somewhere like, Africa, or you're going somewhere like Nicaragua, and there isn't a grid. In some countries like Ethiopia, there's no grid at all anywhere. So most of the world is running on diesel generators. Now, that's highly wasteful. Remember, we already talked about 30%. Is the only extractable energy in most cases as electricity. So how do we do a better job? And with alcohol, we have several interesting things we can do. And so in a shipping container format, we can make alcohol. We can also make electricity from running a diesel generator. We can take the exhaust, which is carbon dioxide and water, and then compress it to dry ice. So for a developing country where no refrigeration is possible because there's no electricity, the alcohol plant can actually deliver blocks of dry ice to community refrigerators that are in shipping container format with lockers, and people can actually refrigerate their food in between, you know, with the alcohol plant providing that chilling with dry ice, which is solid CO2. Now, what's important about that is about 40% of the world's food goes to waste because it spoils before mm-hmm. people can eat it or in the various parts of the distribution chain. Imagine if you are in a country where that happens and all of a sudden where people are maybe going hungry, now you're not wasting food. So instead of a 40% waste, maybe you're down to 5 or 10%. And now many more people are benefiting from the alcohol plant that has multiple byproducts, electricity, cooling, carbon dioxide for crops, all kinds of things that can come out of the process because it's just good design.
But, you know, there are, of course, a couple of things that I wanted to pursue, but one of them, and this has to do with more with environmental economics.
Yes.
Right. Which is that in essence, what you've done is you're internalizing the costs of what are otherwise externalities, like the waste, the organic waste, right? Otherwise, you have to pay for it to put it in a landfill, right? And what you're doing is by bringing it into this integrated system, are essentially extracting all of these different useful products.
Right.
And, you know, for me, you know, as a teacher in classrooms where you don't have actual plants operating, right, it's all very conceptual.
Yes.
And so I'm really sort of fascinated by this whole issue of, you know, how do you ultimately internalize the waste products from various kinds of production processes. So have you thought about that at all?
Oh, sure. Because, you know, it's back to what you and I started talking about, which is there's no bad or good. There's no waste or whatever. There's just surpluses and shortages. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have seen my operation here in Watsonville, which shows how we squeeze all the value out of every step in the process. And so, so that's just good design. In other words, we don't ever look at something as a waste. In fact, I, you know, that's a foreign language I don't speak, which is waste. You know, there's only surplus. So if we take the nutrients that are coming out of the alcohol plant, which is everything except for the solar part, well, the first thing I might want to do, because there's so much of it, is run it through my methane digester. Mm-hmm. So now I, different organisms, because yeast, of course, made the alcohol, the same ones that make bread or beer, you mm-hmm. know. But now if I take the waste left over after I've taken the alcohol out, well, I put that in the methane digester and bacteria gobble up that remaining waste, which is like plant fiber and stuff like that, and makes methane gas. Methane is otherwise known as natural gas. And I use that for my boiler fuel in the alcohol plant. So I don't buy anything from PG&E for the heat energy to distill my alcohol. I get it from my waste product. But nutrients. Yeah. But at the end of my methane digester, I have a surplus. I have all this nutrient-rich water, which no solids are left. It's just liquids, but it's a lot of nutrients. Too much of a good thing is also pollution. So that liquid goes into my cattail marsh. Okay. Now, we've all seen cattails, or the plants that are in marshy areas that have like a hot dog on top, right? Mm. Well, students and with my help back in the 70s built the first cattail marsh sewage treatment plant, where we took liquid nutrients, which is what sewage is, and the cattails absorb all the nitrates out of the sewage, the big pollution, and then the cattails grow. The water is denitrified to the point where it's below 10 milligrams per liter, which is the EPA limit of what clean water is, and now you can actually discharge it into the ocean or river because it's just like the water coming out of a national forest. Mm-hmm. So we've taken that surplus nitrates and we've made plants with them. Well, these plants have multiple uses. The roots are full of starch, which we make into alcohol more than any other plant, land plant. Then we can take the alcohol itself and use it to extract the protein from the leaf matter and get 15 tons of protein per acre compared to 2 tons from corn. And the fiber that's left over after we've done that, we can pelletize, you know, because it's wood fiber basically, and then we can use that instead of wood in a boiler. So in New Zealand, where I'm doing some work right now, they use coal to fire boilers at a dairy for all the pasteurization and stuff. But if we do cattail marshes to capture all the cow runoff, the manure and the urine going across the landscape, we keep it out of the rivers, we grow the cattails, we make the alcohol that we can sell to replace the oil that's imported into the country, mm-hmm. because New Zealand doesn't have any oil, and we also get the protein for the cows from the leaves, right, because we're now growing those instead of grass, and we pelletize and replace the coal with the wood fiber. So that whole stuff that we just did, we just designed that a few weeks ago for the country of New Zealand, and they're going to do it.
So we only have a few minutes left, and I went with a colleague of mine to do the tour, and afterwards, we were having this conversation about why is this kind of thinking and doing so uncommon? If you're an engineer, you build a big plant, and you don't think about these other things, right? But you know, it's part of design. But by and large, design is not integrated, it's not systemic or systematic, right? And our question was, did you get to this because of the 40 or 50 years of work that you've done in these general areas? Or, you know, is there something else, you know, is there something else going on here? It's a kind of a...
Well, I'm cheating. I got a good head start on design because I'm an ecologist by training.
Yeah.
What an ecologist is, you know, which is separate than being an environmentalist. An ecologist is a scientist who looks at the relationships of all things in a system. Well, gosh, if you apply that to human activities, the same observation and sensibility about all parts of the system having, you know, surpluses and shortages and where they have to go, it's a pretty good way to start being a farmer, which I also am, but also in terms of looking at our energy system as an overall human nature system mm-hmm. that has surpluses and shortages. Mm-hmm. So I use that same language a lot, and I got that from my background as an ecologist, and then as someone who, I'm not an engineer by training, but I'm pretty clever that way. So I think differently than most people. In other words, if you say, I've got this surplus, my answer is, you're so lucky, before I even know what to do with it.
You know, the thing is, though, if you look at ecology nowadays as a discipline, it's very reductionist, it's very focused.
Ecology nowadays...
It's a science and not much, you know, it's not a technique, I guess is what you would call it.
It's a regulatory science. In other words, what ecology became was, ecology education became, how do you get a job to help corporations get their permits? In other words, unless you're an academic ecologist,
that's
your work.
Well, I'm of course talking about academic, no, I understand what you're saying. I'm talking about academic ecologists but see, that gets back to this, we only have a couple of minutes, but this gets back to this question that my colleague and I were discussing, right? Which is that unless you've had this very broad sort of experience, right, in these different areas and are able to kind of cross-fertilize.
Broad experience is the answer. In other words, we don't do that nowadays.
We get
people to specialize. When I first started teaching alcohol fuel production, I go around the United States and teach 100 people, and 25 of them will go out and build a distillery and weld it up themselves and start making alcohol. Uh-huh. That's gone. Welding is something that happens in Korea now. Okay. So people don't have that grounding in the physical arts anymore, along with the academic arts. And I grew up in the trades, so I knew how things worked. And then I became an ecologist, so I know how things work, and I know the machines that I need to build to do what works. So
what we need is a university that does that, and then maybe, you know, maybe that's something that you can start next, is a, you know, university out there.
I think that's a good idea.
Okay, well, look, even though you were late, thank you so much for your time. When's your next open house?
Well, what I'm going to say is we don't have one scheduled, but if you go to our website at bloomdistillation.com, mm-hmm. So bloomdistillation.com, that's Bloom the other way, BLUME.
Yep.
And we'll let you know when the next open house is, and you can see the whole ecological way of doing business.
Yeah, absolutely. There was one back in October, right?
Yes, there was.
If you have the chance and the opportunity, go do it. All right. So on January 26th, I'm going to welcome members of Extinction Rebellion, you know, previously scheduled, to talk about their movement strategies, goals, and activities. Extinction Rebellion defines itself as a nonviolent rebellion against the U.S. government for its criminal inaction on the ecological crisis. So this will be a chance to hear from people who are involved in activism and out in the street. Just a reminder, I've archived program broadcasts, and you can find them at tinyurl.com/RESD6JB. I always welcome fan mail from my from Flounders and other fans. And until next other Sunday, sustainability now.
Watch out now, boy, about to get too hot there. My Uncle Bill's got a still on the hill where he runs off a gallon or two. Little birds in the sky get struck, they can't fly from smelling that good old Mountain Dew.